jazz pianist extraordinaire Oscar Peterson, who Duke Ellington called the Maharaja of the keyboard, with his own jazz and gospel composition, Hymn to Freedom. He wrote it in 1962 in support of the civil rights movement, and it became an anthem. Performed here with two other legendary musicians, Ray Brown on bass and Ed Thigpen on drums. Oscar Peterson was born in Montreal, Canada, and died in Mississauga, Ontario, on December the 23rd, 2007, 14 years after suffering a severe stroke. He was 82 years old. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and a program I hope you will enjoy today. The appellation, the People's Attorney General, befits Alton H. Maddox, Jr., who for more than half a century has been engaged in vigorous struggle against American apartheid. Battling an inherently uneven, unfair, and immoral system engineered to throttle the well-being, opportunities, and progress of people of color while assuring rights, privileges, and social, political, and economic control to whites. Long before the Noonan, Georgia-born Maddox became a lawyer, he had placed himself in service to distressed communities. But it was in the Bantustans of the North, most notably in New York City, that Maddox came into the fullness of big city apartheid and his role in battling it, both inside and outside of the courts. He has paid an enormous price, but he continues the struggle. We begin today the first of an extended series of conversations with Alton Maddox, who is a treasure in our midst. And I want to re-emphasize that very often, especially in the African-American community, we do not recognize the value of the effort made without any space for contradiction. We do not recognize and embrace and support and surround the heroes that we have. I'm not going to wait till Black History Month to do it. I've been doing this for years. But it is especially poignant, in my view, at this time, to take some time out and get to understand the nature of struggle, not just among us as a group of people and among people, like-minded people who understand the nature of struggle in the United States, but to commend, to salute, and support those who have paid such an enormous price for their decision to be of service to the community. Welcome, Alton. Great to have you with us today.
Eutrice, I'm tempted to say what a good trial lawyer would say at the end of that great introduction, and then leave you with these words: I rest my case.
Well, I have often said on this program and in the newspaper that I ran, the City Sun, I've always said that I don't know of any other attorney. Of course, it's not to say that there aren't any other such attorneys, because I'm aware that before you came along, there were others that blazed the trail. But as a legal tactician, I don't know of any that would come close to equaling your prowess in a court, I would want to just begin by saying how I got to know you. Covering the courts in Brooklyn, I ran into a group of elderly men. This is a thing that they would do to just pass the time. They would go down to the court and observe cases. And then they got extremely excited. And they were rounding up the group to go over to the court because there's this case they had to see, and they had to see it simply to witness opening statements by this black lawyer. And they were just so enthusiastic about it and so full of admiration. And I understood why. When you make an opening statement, I tell you, it's drama. It's drama. In fact, in one story that I wrote, I called it High Drama at High Noon in Court. And that was the case in which you defended the Reverend Al Sharpton. And within a matter of about 15 or 20 minutes, you dispatched about 8 of the witnesses that the prosecution had intended to call to sink Al Sharpton, and you just, one right after the other. It was an amazing thing to see. So that is how I got to know you personally, by hearing about people marveling at your prowess in a courtroom. And I must say, they weren't exaggerating at all. So why don't I start there with the lamentable state of legal representation in the courts these days, and the impact from your point of view that it has had on the beleaguered community of African Americans, Latinos especially. And today, we can't take for granted that equal justice is to be obtained in a court of law.
Well, Eutrice, you know, one of the things I would like to say is that I always give thanks to my beginnings, because in the 50s and 60s, when there was no court TV at all, and there was no real entertainment other than to wait for a great black lawyer to come to Noonan. And when that person came, mostly in the form of Donald Hollowell, the entire town of Noonan was shut down. I mean, white, black, and everybody, because it was just like a big prize fighter, you know, and the blacks were there to watch Hollowell do his thing, and whites were there, some of them were there to watch the prosecution try to destroy a black man. And so, you know, that became the real highlight of Noonan, Georgia. And in many ways, you know, there were so many things surrounding that. I mean, I can't even call them all today. But, you know, that's really where it started, with the Kaieda Judicial Circuit, which was the judicial circuit in which you had judges who rode the circuit. So it's not like in New York where they would just be in one county. They would actually ride the different circuits, different counties, you know, like maybe Carroll County and Hurd County and some other counties surrounding Kaieda County. And that's basically where we really found our entertainment and our real encouragement. And that's really what I really found most encouraging, and particular case in which there was a black man who lived right across the street from me by the name of Marion Florence. And so Marion had gone out on a Friday night, and he came back the next day and just got tired and went home and got some rest. But by the time he got back to the job, there was so much of a backlog that the grocers were irate, And so Marion had to defend himself. And in defending himself, he ended up pulling out a knife and going to work on the owners of the grocery store. And but to make a long story short, they brought in Donna Hollowell, Marion's mother, Miss Willina Florence, brought in Donna Hollowell. And Donna Hollowell was just fantastic. I mean, to the extent that, you know, Marion could just really have been thoroughly surprised by the performance that Hollowell gave in the court, and ended up where the jury came back and sentenced Marion to a year in the county jail. And so, you know, I mean, for Marion, you know, to go from cutting up two white men to be sentenced to a year in the county jail was just absolutely shocking to him. And so when Hollowell told Marion, well, Marion, I would like to take this upstairs because I can get this whole thing knocked out. Marion said, no, don't do that. You know, I can do a year standing up or whatever time it is, you know, to serve this sentence, but I don't want to disturb you. So Mary's so upset that the court will go to reverse that he just took that 1 year. You know, but that was really one of the cases that really encouraged me, because Mary lived right across the street from me, and where I live on Wheat Street, it was just like a family there among all of us. And so, you know, I just took that really as the real encouraging sign that I had to go to law school eventually.
Well, you have had a reputation of taking some of the most difficult cases. I remember one in which a teenage boy in Brooklyn was charged with murdering a priest. Nobody, none of the great lawyers on Court Street would touch it. But you took that case.
And
why did you take that case?
Well, I think really because of Marion and what happened in his case, where really most lawyers don't really want to take on a very controversial case. And so I would really never take on a case until somebody told me nobody would take this case. And that was the case that inspired me. You know, that was the case I felt like I had to take. Just going back to Marion and the experiences in Coyote County. And so that is why I really ended up just only taking the most difficult and impossible cases that anybody could imagine, because it was only when somebody said, well, nobody else would take this case, that I really got excited in those cases.
Well, that case involved a priest who would troll, oddly enough, in front of a federal court in Brooklyn at night and pick up little boys, sexually aggressively make contact with them, except that this little boy decided that he was just not going to be a victim. He shot and killed the priest. It was a very extraordinarily difficult case, and nobody would touch it. But I think you lived long enough to receive a letter even from the Archdiocese acknowledging the delicacy with which you handled that case. That was very interesting. Another case that you had was the Willie Boskett case. Uh-huh. Could you talk a bit about that?
Well, let me first say one quick thing by the first case that you mentioned. That was Andre Nichols. And in Andre Nichols' case, he was out on parole. He was not supposed to have any type of weapon on him at all. And he actually came in and confessed to the police that he was in possession of a weapon, and he did kill the priest. So, you know, that's where I had to start. But making it more difficult was the fact that it was really near the beginning of the Howard Beach case, you know. And so a lot of people who, when I took that case, said, Maddox, you're absolutely nuts, because, you know, you had a chance to really make a point out of getting a special prosecutor and all of that, And now you're throwing this away because you know the media going to be there watching this other case of Andre Nichols. And, you know, now everything's going off in smoke. So it was really a greater challenge than I had anticipated because I really had not even thought about Howard Beach at that moment. I was just thinking about this young man who was being prosecuted for killing a priest. And so, but as it ended up, actually, you know, he got acquitted, Andre Nichols. And at the time when the jury was polled, I remember the judge telling his court clerk, will you poll the jury? And so the clerk got up and he said to the jury, that's your verdict, that's your verdict, that's your verdict. He did 12 times. And each one of them said, that's my verdict, meaning basically he would have been acquitted. And so after that, the clerk said to the judge, what date for sentencing? And so the judge said, fool. I mean, you polled the jury. You wasn't listening. This man leave here. You know what I mean? And so that became quite comical, you know. But it was one of the extraordinary cases, you know. And like I said before, you know, I mean, I enjoyed them all because I really like that kind of adrenaline flowing, you know, among myself. And that seemed like to be the only way I really had that kind of adrenaline when it was really an impossible case to win. But then when we got to Willie Boskett, first of all, Willie Boskett was a notorious criminal in close quotes. And he had really brought about the juvenile offender law where, you know, you could prosecute a child as an adult. And so Boskett had been credited with being the most vile criminal in New York, even though he was a youngster. And he would go on the subway train and just kill people, you know, put out his gun and just start popping people. And he just had a big reputation of that. And, man, what was interesting, though, is that Willie Boskett never had met his father. But his father was a person, and it seemed as though, when you trace it all, his father had seemingly had a similar type of background, but his father had actually, after being prosecuted and convicted, had actually been sent out to Fort Leavenworth to serve his time. And while at Fort Leavenworth, he actually became the first Phi Beta Kappa inmate in the history of the United States. I mean, you know, he was at the top of his class, you know, and all of that. And then the New York Times got an investigation going on who Willie Boskett's father was, who Willie Boskett was, and they went all the way back to Africa. And they ended up writing this book called All God's Children, and which showed that the Boskett's were just a rebellious family that got into South Carolina and rebelled there and, you know, just came up to New York and were rebelled there. But the point of it is that the family was just so smart and so intelligent that this was their frame of reference. And what has happened, which is tragic to me, is that, you see, because I have been debarred, not disbarred, but since I've been debarred, I don't have no way of reaching Willie Boskett at all. And so I don't know where he is, you know, but I can't reach him. And it hurts me to know that this great young man who has so much gift and prominence, you know, maybe dead, maybe alive, but I have no way of being in contact with. And it's just very emotional for me, you know, to see some of these people because, you know, the thing with me, you treat, it hurted me every time I tried a case. I mean, it just hurted me to have to represent black people that way. And, you know, it's just an emotional thing. I still feel very emotional about it. And I think about, you know, Willie Boskett. I think about Booker Briggs and some others. And, you know, it's just a painful thing. Black people don't really realize what the criminal justice system is really all about.
Well, let's take a cue from what you just were talking about. These cases are not nearly the full breadth of the cases that you have taken on.
No.
As I understand it, you have never charged your client. or your clients for the work that you have been doing, because some of these cases in your mind are symbolic and they are testing. So they are looked upon by you as test cases. First of all, do you feel, let's talk about this debarment, and how is it we don't hear about that term. We hear disbarment, but we never hear about debarment. And how did that occur? When did that occur?
Well, it occurred at the time that when I first got noticed that something was getting ready to happen, was when Professor Alan Dershowitz wrote an op-ed piece in the Albany Times Union. And he called for my disbarment at that particular time and basically told the legislature that they had to really act on me because I had just become too dangerous in the courthouse. And before that, the New York Post had wrote an editorial also urging the New York legislature to take action against me because I was really just too dangerous to be practicing law. And so as a result of that, the New York legislature filed what is called a bill of attainder. And the bill of attainder is something that was outlawed in the U.S. Constitution because you can't allow the legislature to decide the fate of lawyers. And so you have to do something other than that. So the problem that they had was when they went out to find judges to testify against me, nobody would. I mean, every judge in New York State said, no, I love this man, you know. And see, the key was is that I always knew one thing, that white judges wanted to continue to go up the ladder. You know, you just don't become a judge forever in one sighting. I mean, you can go up to the appellate division, go to the Court of Appeals, you can go to federal courts, you know, and all that. So it's always a ladder that you can take advantage of. And so what I realized was is that if I took a case and if I became an educator to the judges, because, you see, a lot of times judges have studied things in law school, but they have never really understand what happened and how you resolve those kind of cases. And so what I would do would be able to create a controversy in the legal system where the judge would say, wait a minute, I read about this in law school, but now I got this case, I don't know how to resolve it. And so, you know, whatever was, I would be there to say, well, you know, Judge, I know how to resolve it. I understand it. I understand how you develop. And so every time the judge would say, you know what, Maddox, I mean, I never knew how good you were, you know, and I've learned something. And so it just became well known in the legal circles that, you know, this is a man that you just have to respect him. And so that's why I never had a problem telling any client that I had. I mean, there were three things I would tell any client. One, I'm going to Mirandize you, which means that you can't tell me anything. Two, I'm going to swear your witness to silence because I'm not going to call them. So you're not going to have any alibi witness. You're not going to have anybody of any kind to testify on your behalf. And third, I'm not going to let you dehumanize yourself by pleading guilty. So those were my three rules I told every client, you know. And so then it put everything on my back, you know, and that's the way I rolled that particular way. I just put every client on my back and just went from there.
But let's get to the debarment.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
How did that occur?
Well, as I said before, after the New York Post and Alan Dershowitz did what they did, and after they hadn't been able to find anybody to file a complaint against me, and had not been able to find any client to file a complaint against me, the legislature just simply said, and they're listed, they just simply said, we're going to just stop this man, period. You know, and that's what happened. So that meant that there was no complaint of any kind. And what I did was, when it finally came, as I had been, suspended and all of that, and then they said, well, we got to give you some kind of hearing. I said, well, look, I'm not going to have a star chamber proceeding, okay, which meant that you're not going to do this in secret, you know, because that's what they do with lawyers. They don't let other people attend the hearings. And so I got the first hearing ever, which was open to the public. And so after I got the hearing that was open to the public, what I knew was that one day black people going to wake up and get a chance to demand a copy of my proceedings and realize that this was all a hoax in the first place. This, they didn't have no evidence against him. There was no complaint. There was nobody there testifying against him. So how did we sleep this? You know what I mean? And so that's where we are now. I mean, I'm keep trying to tell people, look, man, just ask for the transcript. You know, because it's not secret anymore. If I had not been who I am, you know, had decided that I won't have a secret proceeding, it would have been. But it's an open proceeding. I don't have nobody in New York who have the audacity or boldness to just say, well, I want to see that transcript. And so that's where the problem is. And what I always say is a debarment. It's not a disbarment. And debarment is listed in the Black's Law Dictionary. There's a definition for that. And as I said before, if you look at the Constitution, you realize that what happened to me was just totally unconstitutional. But you also realize this, Utree. By the time that they finally got around to dealing with me, I had just become invincible. I don't want to pat myself, but that's just a reality. I could win any case. It didn't make no difference what it was. You know, only thing you had to do is just come out and say, I got a case. And I said, well, you know, give me an accusatory instrument and go home. And I would just go and win the case. And that's what they began to realize. This man is just too dangerous. Nobody should be this good. And, you know, the thing about it is, you were there when Bill Consul gave me this tribute. You remember that? Over there, yes. In Brooklyn, in New York County.
Yes.
And, you know, and Bill will always write me a letter. He said, Alton, if you can't win this case, nobody in New York can, because that's just how good you are. You know, he said, you know, and that's just the reality. So he will always compliment me every time, you know, that I won a case. He would just say, you know what, Alton, there's nobody else ever in New York could win these kind of cases. You're just too good.
But debarment was coinciding. It coincided with your representation of this case, the Brawley case, the Tawana mm-hmm. Brawley case.
Right.
And no matter what they did, they couldn't do it legally and openly. But this, your debarment, is the first time in history, I believe, legal history, mm-hmm. that a state legislature, mm-hmm. you weren't disciplined or you weren't debarred by the lawyer's committee, or you didn't have a disciplinary charge ever before the committee. Mm-hmm. You had nothing pending. But the state attorney general, Robert Abrams, mm-hmm. requested that the state legislature, it has never happened before in history, mm-hmm. a legislature should take action against this one attorney, Alton Maddox. Mm-hmm. Now, it boggles the mind that this is standing even now as a legal action without review, without objection. And it basically says that the entire legal system of the state of New York was a co-conspirator mm-hmm. in this action. That's my estimation of it. Why were you punished for representing Tawana Brawley?
Well, you know, I think the other thing people got to realize is that black women constitute a special group in slavery. You know, I mean, we had the Me Too movement and all of that, and that's great, you know, and because none of that should be happening. But black women have a special heading. You know, I mean, that the experience of the black woman is just so much different than the experience of, you know, of anybody else. And I think that actually in 1951, Utrecht, and I can remember this to this very day, I was in Atlanta, Georgia, 368 Newport Street in Atlanta, and my uncle, Carl Sim, came, and he left this literature, and I was already reading. I mean, 6 years of age, I mean, you'd be surprised at the genius of my early teachers and the kind of values that they really instilled. And they had taught me to really, at that particular time, read case about the Korean conflict and things of that nature. That's how well I was reading. I was reading the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, the Atlanta Constitution, all these papers, and then I was reading all of the black newspapers that we got on Thursdays from Ms. Reese, who had a route that she would bring all these papers in. And I was reading everything. I mean, you know, like Peg Leg Bates, everything. I was just dreaming about everything that existed. And so, you know, as a result of that, I decided that when I read this story about the lynching of Mary Turner in South Georgia, I mean, it just blew my mind at 6 years of age. And I think from that moment on, a lot of times people who I was going to school with did not really know how radical I really was, you know. But, I mean, when I read about what they did to Mary Turner, how they lynched her, how they, after that, you know, she had a baby, she was pregnant, a baby fell out, and they stomped the baby to death. I mean, it just turned my whole life around that very day, you know. And I just sort of, like, had a greatest respect for black women, you know, and what they had to face. And it just really, you know, just changed me, you know, as a person. And I remember when I was in the seventh grade, you know, I had this one young lady who was there, and she would always think that, you know, well, he's scared of black women. I wasn't afraid of black women. I love black women, you know. The thing about it, I just loved them so much. I had so much respect for them that I had no interest in really developing no romantic relationships because of the real strong love that I did have for them. I mean, I'm not saying I didn't have some romantic relationships, but it was just far and few in between. And I think it was one of those things where I just couldn't be one of those people just want to run around and just run with black women. But I just had to have a real respect for them. And I think that really, that day in 1951, the lynching of Mary Turner just really turned my whole life around.
Well, I still want to probe a little bit more on this debarment, which was ordered by the state attorney general. If anything, he should have done it if he had the guts. But with the consent of then Mario Cuomo, Governor Cuomo, going all the way back then, to single you out and to debar you via the state legislature. You have no record at all as a professional attorney doing anything untoward. You have no complaints from any clients at all about your representation of them. You have no history at all of insulting, but in fact, as I read the order, you were in fact debarred for, quote, embarrassing the state of New York, unquote. And you embarrassed the state of New York because you confronted them with all the illegalities that they had committed in this Brawley case, and they were not interested at all in dealing with them. So you had to go. They, as I said, they couldn't get the Bar Association. It would have had no reason whatsoever to take any action against you. So the way they felt that they could accomplish this was to have the state legislature move against you. Is there any such incident in the legal field anywhere else in the United States where a state legislature debar indefinitely, which means you have no hope? Even if you were disbarred, as Bill Clinton was, you would have had the opportunity to appeal and reapply. But they saw to it, they shut you down completely. Is there any hope at all that this will be rectified?
Well, let me say this. You have a very relevant question, and I really stopped in terms of explaining everything. But, you know, Steve Pagonis filed his lawsuit, Pagonis versus Maddox, Mason, Shopton, and Brawley.
Identify Stephen Pagonis.
Hmm?
Identify Steve Pagonis, yeah, so Steve, people know.
Stephen Pagonis was an assistant district attorney in Dutchess County. And I did not know of him. As a matter of fact, on December 12th, 1987, I was actually in Atlanta, Georgia. And at that particular time, that was the final continuing legal education course for the year. And so I had no other alternative but to be in Georgia on December 12th. And as it turned out, you had people like Maynard Jackson, who was there. And Maynard had been a good friend of mine for a few years because he and I, Willie P. Mitchell, my father, had made it possible for him to be a delegate to the 1968 Democratic National Convention. And then after that, he ultimately became mayor of Atlanta, Georgia. But we were all there in Buckhead on December 12th, taking this course. And at the same time, I told Sonny Carson that I, for the first time, would have to have somebody to set up some type of legal defense fund for me, because this was a difficult case, and it was a different case. Because, you see, black women to themselves may not understand that the fact that the white man really believes he owns us, or owns our women. I mean, he really does. And there's a lot of us in denial about that. And I knew it was going to be a very difficult case, much more different than anything else I had gotten involved in. And what I did right after that, I went up to Dutchess County myself because everybody was sort of slow in moving. And I said, well, I'm going to Dutchess County myself and start doing some investigation. And that's what I did. And during the time that I was up there, it was about 500,000 people in Dutchess County. But in that time, I had gained evidence on everybody who was involved in the case. So, you know, and now I go to the courthouse one day, I didn't know this, but there was a postman by the name of Tom Lucy, who was actually in the courthouse himself, testifying that he had seen these black white men in this particular type of car, which fitted the car of Harry Chris. And if anybody
Harry
was
Chris
involved...
Harry Chris is a part-time police officer.
Harry, right.
Was among the people that became associated as suspects in this case.
Right. That's true. And so he was testifying that this was the kind of car they was in and all of that. Now, at the same time, I was outside of the courthouse, and I had been driven up there by one of Donald Trump's trustees, Perry McKenna, because Perry had been promised by Donald Trump that he would get Perry a job. You know, and then all of a sudden, you know, later Perry flipped on us. And I suppose at that time, Donald Trump must have told him to flip and bring some questions about us, because I was certain that Donald Trump was involved in this case. You know, I mean, people may not, you know, if you don't live in New York, you may not understand that. But Donald Trump was a very busybody. You know what I mean? Just like he is today. You know, he hasn't changed. You know, he would be this kind of person to watch the news, see what was going on in the news and all that kind of stuff. And that's just the way he was. And so Perry and I went up there, and I was outside the courthouse holding a press conference, telling the people outside, telling the media that, you know, I had evidence of who did it. Now, at the same time, Tom Lucy is the postman inside telling the people the descriptions of the men who fit, who were involved. And the DA's office being said, wait a minute, this sounds like Steve Pagoda's and his crew. And so that's when they panicked, you know, right at that particular time. Because they thought I knew everything. I just knew some things. I didn't know everything at that point. But I knew enough to get them scared. And that's when they said, wait a minute, we got to go and recuse ourselves and bring in a new prosecutor because Steve Pagonas is one of the suspects. Now, as you know, they didn't put that in writing because they hid the identity of the suspect was, but it was Steve Pagonas. And so, you know, as a result of that, I ended up knowing who he was, and that's when they panicked because, you see, there were some very influential law enforcement police officer involved in this case. I mean, Steve Gomez himself was ADA. His father was a judge. He had another uncle who was a circuit court judge, you know, and so he had a lot of influence. The number two man in the entire New York State Police was involved, and so, you know, obviously he had influence, and so it just became that. And you know, I really had really stepped into a powder keg, so to speak, you know. And then at that point, they just said, wait a minute, we got to crush Maddox and anybody else around him, you know, because this is too dangerous and we got too many important people involved in this case.
So I want to ask a question again. What would have to happen? Or is it too late? Or are you just over it? What has to happen to revive this application, and not just that application, let me take that back, to revive your position that this debarment was not only unconstitutional, but it borders on criminality, conspiracy of criminality, to basically harm you by removing you from the ability to make a living. So what is the future of this particular cause of action?
Well, and I'd be glad to answer that because, you know, I live with it every day. When we got ready to go up to Poughkeepsie, where the trial was going to be held, at that particular time, you know, obviously you were not available then. And so you had a lot of people who had some programs because, you know, Clayton and I were trying to encourage you not to get into radio, you know. You may remember that, you know. And so obviously, you know, we didn't want to see you in radio because we wanted to see you stay as a newspaper person, you know. But as fate turns around, you know, you involved in radio against my wish and against the wish of Clayton Jones, you know. Because, you know, we had a long meeting in Brooklyn, you know what I mean? About
yes.
That. A lot of people may not know that, but we did. So actually, so the people that were actually in charge of radio were not really kind. And we didn't really have any black person who was sympathetic to my request that we at least be able to tell black people in New York that the case is getting ready to start and they all need to come up there. Now, as it happened, and this is how things get real funny. Sean Hannity and I were longtime friends. But we were longtime friends only because we didn't agree with each other on anything. I mean, if I said north, Sean said south. And for whatever reason, it happened that Sean just found me to be a great guest for him because he knew I was going to just go toe-to-toe with him, nose to nose, but in a directly different manner. So, you know, and from his perspective, he appreciated it. I suppose it helped his rating. So we had developed that kind of relationship where we could disagree without being disagreeable. And so without getting any interest from anybody in radio in our community, you know, I called Sean and said, Sean, I need to go on radio, and I need to pump up, you know, this Brawley case and whatever. And, you know, even though I'm sure Sean didn't believe, you know, into Warner Brawley, and he wanted to work against us. He didn't do that. You know, he just said, okay, well, Alton, you know, just come on. I'll give you whatever airtime you need. So that is the relationship that Sean Hannity and I have. Now, in the meantime, you know, when we had to get ready to go to court up there, I mean, it was the longest civil trial in the history of New York, but we packed the courthouse every day because black people just started seeing an interest in the case. So the jury's looking there, and they say, wait a minute. Every day this courthouse is packed. And these people must be coming from at least New York, which is 100 miles away. And so, you know, it gives people the impression that something else must be going on here. You see what I'm saying? Because you don't want to be up there by yourself and don't have no audience, you know. And then they say, well, you know, it's just like everybody thought. But when they start seeing the courthouse packed every day, you know what I mean? That started turning things around. And, you know, and then we went from there. Now, in the meantime, what had happened was, I had taken a number of depositions of Pagonis. And so I knew that I was surprised that he would even go to trial, Eutrice, because I had just nailed him, you know. And what I did, if you recall, this was around the time when New York experimented with the idea of a televised trial. And so they had this rule in the court rules where they allow for a televised trial. So the first day we started the depositions, I said to the adversary that I wanted recorded. And so the opposition said, no, you can't have that. I said, oh, I think I can. And so they said, well, no, we can't. I said, well, look, this is the rule and regulation here. And I followed it to every letter of the law. And they looked at it, and I said, and here's your certificate of mailings and all of that. You got it. And, you know, and I'm entitled to do that. And so as a result of that, that's how we recorded his entire testimony. I have his entire testimony right now in depositions. So now you have his entire testimony in depositions, and now we got we hopefully can get the transcript. But Andrew Cuomo is resisting the transcript. Once I'm able to get those two transcripts and also be able to show that New York had actually debarred me a year earlier. Black people didn't know that. They didn't just disbar me then. They had debarred me earlier. And so, you know, if we could just put all this out on the table, I mean, people would definitely have a whole different understanding of what this case is. It's really a matter of education. And, you know, and when we say keep the pressure on, what that means is what Adam Clayton Powell said. What's in your hands? And so what's in your hand, meaning the person who may read me say keep the pressure on, is a telephone. Or a computer. And that just doesn't mean get to work. Start calling these people. You know what I mean? Every day. That's what it means. Because that's the only way you get respect. Because they're not going to respect you automatically. So keep the pressure on. Just start calling these people. Like today, start calling the governor of Georgia. Start calling the governor of Alabama. Start calling Donald Trump. You know what I mean? That's the way that we got to be able to get this thing resolved. And I'm sure if we do, we will.
Well, we're coming close to the end of the program, but I want to advise people that this is not a self-contained one-off kind of conversation. We'll be talking in successive conversations about things that people don't really know, not just about Alton Maddox, but about the condition that he, as an attorney, tried to rectify and confront in courts of law. And we will talk about the paucity of such individuals now and what that means for the community as a whole, where with lackluster representation, sometimes no representation, sometimes incompetent representation, what the impact has been, and it has been real in the African American and Latino communities. We'll talk about this particular case, the Brawley case, in greater detail, because in many ways it illustrates what is wrong, the bifurcation, the racial bifurcation in the law and in the administration of the law, the institution of the law, and what it the end result usually is. It's one of, in my view, I covered the case extensively, it is one of the most significant cases in modern history, if I could even be so bold. So, Alton, as we wrap up, how do you see your place in legal history?
Well, I tell you right now, Eutrice, I'm fighting to keep us from going into the gas ovens, because it shouldn't be a surprise to a lot of people. But, you know, Donald Trump tried to execute 8 innocent young men, all right? And he did everything he could to put them in the death chair. So this man has inclination for executing black people. What we don't understand today is that we don't realize that we knew he was dangerous back in 1989. But he's even more dangerous today because now he's the president. He's not just Donald Trump. He is the president of the United States now. And he has, and people may not know this, just with the stroke of one pencil, he can sign his name and we're all in America be headed to the death camps. Everybody in America, everybody in Puerto Rico, everybody else. That's the kind of power he has, because the Supreme Court has said that the President of the United States, just by simply signing his name to an executive order, can send us all to a concentration camp for execution. That's what we are as a people, and that's why we need to take this very serious. You know, that's the reason why I just cry every day now, you know what I mean, because it's just so emotional to know all the work that we did. And finally, this man, Donald Trump, you know, who tried to send 8 young, innocent young men to the lecture chair, now has the power of the pen to put us all there.
Alton, I want to thank you so much for being with us today and for getting, I would call it, a series of conversations that we need to have. I want to leave ample room for people to talk directly to you, because in so many ways, people are operating in a vacuum, in a, you know, an information vacuum. And many of the cases that you have tried, many of them setting legal precedent, are you have undertaken for a particular purpose. You have undertaken it at great personal expense and great professional expense. And I just want this community as a whole, our whole community, to understand not only who you are, but what you have been doing for 50 years. Thanks so much for being with us again today.
And again, Eutrice, thank you very much for the invitation. And it's something that doesn't happen that often. And when I get the invitation, I will accept the call.
Thank you. Well, stay tuned. That brings us to the end of our program today. Coming up next, Meditations and Molotovs with Vincent Emanuele. Let me know what you think about this program today at leadstories@gmail.com. See you tomorrow. Bye-bye.